Welcome back, everybody, to an extra special episode of Seaweed Brain, a Percy Jackson podcast, because today we are joined by Joe Trace. That is right. That is the book writer for the Lightning Thief musical, also writer for the television show, amongst many other cool titles. You do not want to miss this. Stick around. Joe, welcome to the virtual studio today. We are so excited to have you.
It's so wonderful to virtually be here.
Yay! We've been trying to be better about introducing ourselves on our podcast. So I'm Erica, joined as always by my co-host, Carter.
Hi.
Hi, Erica and Carter.
Joe, we said this briefly, but we're going to run through some of your credits. You wrote the book for the Lightning Thief musical and for Be More Chill. You are a co-executive producer and a writer for Percy Jackson season one on Disney Plus. You also were a story editor and a writer for Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix. And you're the showrunner and creator of Dash and Lily, which is very special, amongst many, many other things. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Yeah, you read that and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm exhausted just hearing all that. I need a nap.
Yeah, and like, I was like really excited to talk to you because all of those things are things like I personally really enjoy. You know, like every single one of the things you have worked on, I have been like obsessed with. Like Series of Unfortunate Events, I loved that adaptation. I watched it religiously. Dash and Lily is so great. I love Troy. He's the best.
Oh, he is the best. I mean, because Troy was in Be More Chill and I stole him for Dash and Lily because he's so awesome.
Exactly. And I know I mentioned to you over email, the one time I saw Be More Chill in 2019, it happened to be a performance where Troy Iwata was on for the lead. And it was like the entire lead cast were all Asian American performers. And that was the first time until K-pop, I think, on Broadway. So that would be one out of only two times where I saw like an all Asian leading cast in a musical. And it just totally rocked my world.
That was amazing. I was so happy when you said you saw that night. That really was an incredibly special night with Stephanie Hsu and Troy on, and then George Salazar, also a Lightning Thief adjacent, and Jason Tam. It was really special to be able to have that.
So Jason Tam went to the same high school as us. And I run into him like everywhere. It's so funny.
We have incredible overlapping circles because I know you guys are friends with Jarrell as well. So, and
yes!
Obviously musical theater fans as well. So I feel like there's so much overlap in what you do, what I do, what you love, what I love.
Exactly. We were like, there's no better person who we could have on our podcast than you. Like being like the Percy Jackson musical theater person. Like you are our niche audience, like represented in a human being. I feel like
it's my two favorite things to talk about. So when I get to talk about the two things together, amazing.
Yay. I actually think the last time you were on a Percy Jackson podcast was Radio Camp Half-Blood. I think it was like 2018 or something. This was a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, the Percy Jackson fandom is mighty, but has, you know, was kind of slumbering. And then, you know, obviously the Disney Plus series has just brought it roaring back to life. But you guys have been kind of fighting the good fight for a while now, kind of spreading the word.
Yeah, I think Radio Camp Half-Blood sort of like trailed off just as we started. I think they had just kind of announced that they were going to go like on hiatus when we started our show. And so it was really cool to listen back. I think that episode that you did with them was like before Be More Chill was even on Broadway. It was like about to go. This was crazy. So we're excited to talk a little bit about like the musical with you and then also like the comparison between working on the musical and then working on the show. But before we do that, would you tell us a little bit about like your career and how you transitioned into first being a playwright and then moving into working for TV?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always loved books and I loved writing, and it kind of took an embarrassing long time to figure out that like adaptation was the natural confluence of those two things. You know, I'm so lucky that a lot of the things that I've worked on have been books that I was a fan of just as a reader before I ever was a professional writer. So, you know, the Percy Jackson series, Lemony Snicket series, you know, these are all things that I, even though I was a little too old to grow up loving them, I like was in my early 20s when these series were coming out, and I was working in a bookstore in the, like the YA middle grade section and just sort of devouring all these things that were on the shelves. I'd like go to the break room.
What bookstore did you work at?
It was a Borders bookstore, which doesn't exist anymore. So
we remember the Borders.
Borders was our childhood bookstore.
Oh, Borders so great. It had like an enormous manga section that you could just like sit in for hours and read like 20 volumes of a manga. And I actually discovered Percy Jackson. The Sea of Monsters had just come out. And we had the advanced reader copy in the break room that I took home and then realized I needed to read the first one first. And so I was a fan from way back when, early 2000s.
I also worked in a bookstore for like 2 years when I first moved to the city.
What bookstore?
I worked at Book Culture, uptown by Columbia. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Much cooler. Less corporate.
But yeah, well, Borders is also great. They replaced the Borders in our local mall with a Ross when I was in high school. And I went on like a Ross boycott because I was like, darn you, Ross.
Never again.
Unculturing America. Yeah.
It really is. You know, I think when I like first started writing, I had that. I was like, well, if it doesn't work out, I can always fall back and go back to Borders. And then Borders went bankrupt and shut down. I was like, nope, guess this writing thing's got to work out.
And it did. I think I heard you tell the story about how sort of the Lightning Thief musical came to be. And then I think it was Theater Works that sort of pioneered that project. And they had a relationship with Rick's literary agent. But then you got involved. Was it through like writing a spec script?
Yeah. So Theater Works USA is a really great company here in New York. They do a lot of like adaptations of children's books into like hour-long shows that tour the country. They play in schools and, you know, community centers and libraries and cafetoriums. And their goal is to sort of bring quality Broadway style theater to people who don't have access to that. So, you know, they have this great mission statement and a really great relationship with publishers. Now, the first Percy Jackson movie had come out, clearly was not a movie that Rick was a fan of, for all the reasons that he has, you know, enumerated on his website over the years.
Right.
So I think he was very hesitant about another adaptation, but because his literary agent had a good relationship with Theater Works, the head of Theater Works, Barbara Pasternak, was able to sort of convince Rick to let her have the rights to do a 1-hour touring show that didn't even have permission to play in New York City, much less like be on Broadway. But you know, it was going to tour around and they were looking for writers. I was writing Be More Chill and looking to do more musical theater. I was visiting my agent to talk about Be More Chill and saw he had The Lightning Thief on his desk. And I was like so excited because I love the book. And I was like, who's doing it? And so I got whatever you call the writer version of an audition. I got a meeting with Theater Works. I had to write a sample scene and originally it was going to be a play, you know, kind of, right. I got the job and wrote the play and was like, okay, this play is crazy. So much happens in 60 pages. And we kind of decided it would help to make it a musical because with music, you can move through story so fast. Music can get at emotion so quickly in a way that like a monologue, you need like, a song is worth 1,000 words. So we brought on Robert Kiki, who's incredible. He was a bandmate of Joe Iconis, who I wrote Be More Chill with. And so Joe had recommended Rob and Rob wrote some sample songs. And, you know, then we're like, yeah, let's do this. Let's make this Percy Jackson musical.
Yeah, and the rest is Percy Jackson history. It's
myth.
How was the process then of like when you realized that songs would add to the project? Was it obvious to everyone else? That's so interesting. I didn't realize that it had been conceived of as a play before a musical.
Yeah, and you know, even I was writing as a play, yeah, like lyrics kept kind of creeping in. Like, I'm not a lyricist. Rob is a wonderful lyricist, but like things kept wanting to go into song because there is that just it, you know, it's fantasy. It wants to push over into something bigger and wilder. And so, you know, we had the idea, let's make it a musical, you know, even though like on one hand, a Percy Jackson musical sounds like a joke. It felt like, look, like you can do things with song. And Rob had such a great sense of like, you know, angsty emo rock for Percy, you know, measured glockenspiel type music for Annabeth, acoustic folk for Grover. Like he had just had a really great sense of how different type, you know, Mr. D gets a, you know, very vaudeville Broadway style number where he kvetches for 5 minutes. Rob had a great sense of like how music could come organically from the characters in ways that maybe when you think musical theater, you maybe, you know, you kind of go to like a showy place. I think Robert wrote music from a really character place. So it ended up being the key to making it work. And then we did get to expand, you know, because the response had been so incredible to the 1-hour touring show, we got to expand it as a 2-hour, two-act show that, you know, toured and then got to end its tour with a Broadway run, which was something we never, ever envisioned for the show. We were like, writing a show that we're like, this is going to play libraries.
I'm so curious from the structural like writing standpoint of the book, how you go from something that is like an hour, like essentially conceived as like theater for young audiences into like a 2-hour, 2-act musical. Like, do you go back in and you're like, okay, this is like the Rodgers and Hammerstein structure would be like this. Do we like replace like certain things here? Like, do we make sure the 11 o'clock number is here still? Or do you just like how did you have that conversation?
Yeah. One of the big things is that in the hour long version, there were no solos. You know, the show kind of functioned like a roller coaster where you got on and there were like ups and downs and loop de loops. And by the end of it, you were like, you know, you and the cast were all like out of breath and panting because it had just, you know, it was a speed run through the book, but it was like a fun, like the joy of it was like, how do you tell a story in this little time. You know, but like we didn't have a time to slow down. Tree on the Hill, which in the, you know, the final version of the show is a, you know, very melancholy, emotional song. It was like done as like a fast paced flashback in the hour long version. You know, it was like action. The pace of the song was totally different because we would test it with kid audiences. And anytime their attention started to flag, we're like, okay, we should probably shave some minutes off there. So, you know, Strong was a shorter version of that, that we got to then expand to the original full length version for the two act show. Good Kid and My Grand Plan, you know, came in because we're like, okay, now we have two acts. We can breathe. Our actors can breathe. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They can plant themselves on the stage and like sing an emotional ballad
for three. Baby.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, all those wonderful songs, and the Campfire song came about because we're like, you know, we want to really live at camp. One of my favorite things about the series is just Camp Half-Blood and getting to like live in this fantasy place. You're like, if I could have this place where I belonged, where everyone was like, not like me because they're different in their own ways, but we like, we share being different in common. And so the, you know, the Campfire song came out of like Rob and I, like I crashed on his couch one night and we just like stayed up all night, like making each other laugh, be like, what if your dad was this God? What if your mom was this God? And putting all those jokes into that song.
Yeah. I think that this is the part of this episode where we just talk at you about how good the musical is and how special that we think it is. Like truly, it captures the silliness and the goofiness and also the like pop punk angst that is Percy Jackson, and tonally just feels so appropriate to the source material. Working on the show then, which is, you know, like obviously a completely different adaptation and it's somebody else's adaptation, like you've been a showrunner before and then for this you are like in the writer's room. What was it like working on somebody else's adaptation of this work that, you know, the tone is similar, but it's also like totally different?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, first of all, John and Dan are incredible. Like they are showrunners. They had such a vision when I first met with them about possibly coming onto the show and working for them in the interview. They talked about some of the things that they'd were thinking about. They talked about, you know, the parallels between Sally and Medusa and really wanting to bring that out. They talked about like mythomagic and wanting to sort of bring that into the story earlier as a way to have Percy already have a sense of the world. So when he sees that Minotaur, he's like, Minotaur wearing underpants. It's just like the mythomagic card. They talked about Grover and it was everything they were saying. I was like, this is incredible. They thought about this so much. And, you know, I've been adapting this book for 10 years.
Right.
And for them to say things that I was like, wow, it just reframed things in a different way for me was really exciting. So, you know, after sort of getting to do the musical version of it, to sort of get to work with them and like have their vision lead and chase that with this incredible writer's room they assembled was really fun. And, you know, as you said, tone is so, you know, I think medium is so dictating of tone. A musical, mm-hmm. there's a suspension of disbelief just built into something you're seeing on stage because there's no way you're going to convince somebody that what they're seeing on the, you know, library or Broadway stage in front of them is actually real. So for the musical, we leaned into that, you know, the monster transformations, the magical transformations were like deliberately lo-fi to sort of capture that like, you know, pop punk energy. You know, we're going to fool somebody into thinking there was a centaur on stage, but we could have an actor stand up from his wheelchair, have a horse tail on and prance around while Chris McCarroll makes faces, and like that sells it on a stage. Obviously,
throw toilet paper to the ceiling.
How to do Percy's water powers on stage was such a challenge. It was Stephen Brackett, our director. We tried so many things. We tried fire extinguishers. We're like, nope, that's not going to work. We tried like you know that would have been fun, but like would have been a huge mess on stage. Very expensive, not safe. You know, we tried you know blue silks, which you know is very Mary Zimmerman, but felt like a little too arty and pretentious for the spirit of Percy Jackson. So you know, I think it was Lee Savage, our set designer, and Stephen Brackett, our director, who came up with a toilet paper idea, which instantly felt right because like Percy first discovers his powers in a bathroom. It's like textually supported. And yet also just like the idea of TPing your enemies is like the most like, you know, adolescent Percy Jackson sticking his nose up at authority thing to do.
I love that you also mentioned Grover in that. First of all, that initial meeting between you and Dan and John must have been like incredible. I would love to get like the meeting notes from that meeting. All of the things that John and Dan like really like wanted to like almost like pitch to you as a writer and say like, this is what we find to be important.
Oh yeah. I mean, adaptation is my favorite thing. I could talk about adaptation all day and, you know, to get to talk to them and hear, you know, what their initial thoughts were, where their heads were going, you know, it was like so exciting to get to hear like, oh wow, here's, you know, first it's like, well, I've been doing the story for so long. do I want to adapt it again? But after talking to them, I was like, yeah, obviously I do. And we have such great leaders to you know, lead the way.
I was listening back to the musical cast recording this morning, and I was like, wow, you know what? Grover in the musical, Arian as Grover in the TV show feels so much closer to Grover in the musical than Grover in the book. And we're sort of like famous Grover book haters, where like he was not our favorite character growing up. Like we didn't find him funny. We were like, okay, cool it with the enchiladas. Like we were not into his humor or anything
put
like that.
Put down those tin cans.
Yeah, like, okay, put down the tin cans. We get it. You're a goat. yeah. But then like Jarrell and obviously George Salazar like are so great in their performances in the musical. And we know that Arian himself is a fan of the musical. And we got to talk to him a little bit about that.
I was so happy you asked him that. I'd also had heard that he loved the musical. And I got to meet him at the premiere at the Met. Rob was my date for that. And getting to meet him and being like, you love the musical. It was so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love Grover. And, you know, I think there's a danger when you have that kind of comic relief character in a trio, particularly in like a, you know, sort of a YA middle grade fantasy trio archetype, for that character to just kind of like be the comic relief in a way that renders them unfunny because that's their only function. But Grover, Rick gave Grover such a great backstory. I mean, you know, just the idea that he's a protector. He was Thalia's protector. He was Annabeth and Luke's protector. Now he's Percy's protector. He's someone who's defined by a job that he's, in his eyes, failed at again and again. And that despite his positive outlook on the world, he's someone who's carrying that sadness inside. And yeah, I think Arian was so good at capturing that. And I love knowing that Arian was a fan of George and Jarrell in the musical, because I'd like to think that he was keeping that spirit alive.
Absolutely. I was going to say, like, I feel like the musical like altered the canon in that way. It set the stage for Arian to step into Grover in the beautiful way that he did in the show.
Yeah. And it's interesting now that, you know, Rick wrote Chalice of the Gods and brought Grover back into a more essential role because, of course, as Percy fans know, Grover kind of fades in prominence in Rick's books as it goes along. And, you know, he obviously takes on a lot of responsibility and ends up off page a lot, but it's been fun to see. And you know, maybe, I don't know, if the musical could have had some small role in bringing Grover back to the prominence that I, as a Grover apologist, think he deserves.
He did nothing wrong. You don't need to apologize.
He did nothing wrong, yeah. Let the goat eat styrofoam.
Yeah, let the goat eat the cans. It's funny. It's funny. I'll admit it. Speaking of the musical, I know somebody asked you about this at the drama bookshop, and I was so happy to hear that when I was listening back to the podcast, specifically about episode 8 of the TV show as it relates to The Last Day of Summer in the musical, because I know was not alone when we saw episode 8 with that opening Luke monologue where he repeats, "Look, you didn't ask to be a half-blood." Everybody was like, oh my God, it's just like when Luke sings a good kid reprise in the middle of the final number of the musical. When you guys were talking about episode 8, is that something that came up or like was referenced back to? I'm so, so curious about the relationship between those two moments in the adaptations.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't talk about the musical much in the writer's room just because it does feel like such a different adaptation. And yet, after spending that long in the musical, I think like I naturally, the same things I gravitated towards when I adapted it for the stage, you know, the idea that there's a parallel between Luke and Percy, that is really one of the things that makes the series so special is you have an antagonist who, you know, he's not Voldemort, he's not like Sauron, you know, you have the Kronos character to be that, but like you have Luke who is so similar to Percy in how he sees the world as broken and similar to Percy in wanting to affect change in the world. It's just he goes about that in such a different way. And so, you know, that was always in the musical something that we were keeping at the forefront is that idea that like this is a story about these two boys and they have, you know, they both see the world in a way that one generation looking at the history that's gone before, the mistakes of the past with clear eyes and saying, the system doesn't work. The system has to change. It just, they go about it in two different ways. And so, you know, I know, you know, Daphne in the writer's room also is a huge Team Luke fan. And
Luke, you know, understander. Luke,
yeah. And so, you know, it really was wanting to make sure the character was as nuanced and dimensional as he is on the page, because you don't just want to make him a stock villain. You want to make him someone who Percy can look at and see himself in, but then also see where Luke goes too far and where he has to pull back and find a different way. So I loved when I read the script and saw that parallel. I loved that was like on the page and felt like so true to the way, you know, I and Daphne and so many of us in the writer's room were always saying, but Luke has a point.
But he has a point, though.
Yeah, not about, you know, the war and you know, wiping out the gods, because, you know, like Percy, I feel there are other solutions. But, you know, the root of that anger is something that I think, like, we could really relate to. And the idea that Luke is giving Percy a choice, he wants to recruit him and not just sort of kill him with a pit scorpion, was something that, mm-hmm. You know, we really were pushing for. I think Daphne especially, she's got the, you know, if she doesn't have a t-shirt that says Luke was right, she should have that t-shirt. But you know, oh yeah, Blame Zeus, amazing. That was the other, Blame Zeus is the other refrain. Although, you know, I will say, like, you watch episode 8 and Lance Reddick's incredible performance as Zeus brings nuance to that character that I think sometimes it's easy to make Zeus the bad guy. And, you know, I think one thing that I really love about how Rick uses the gods is, like, they are nuanced. You know, they're not just this or that. And even, you know, Athena, I want to defend Athena, because I feel like after episode 4, I saw a lot of Athena hate. You know, she's like, mythologies, the stories don't always paint Athena in the best light. You know, her big ones are Arachne, she turns someone into a spider. You know, Medusa, she obviously punishes Medusa instead of punishing the person who deserves it. But one thing we talked about a lot in episode 4 is that Athena is the daughter of Zeus. She has a father who she is trying to please in the same way that Annabeth has a mother she is trying to please. And that when that head was delivered to Olympus, you know, a lot of that episode 4 story came out of thinking about the consequences of mailing that head to Olympus, with Annabeth being privy to that, what that would be for Athena as the mother of this child who is basically sticking a middle finger up to the gods, how furious Zeus would be at Athena, probably, you know, take that out on Athena, who then, when she's lets Echidna into the arch or removes the spell of protection that keeps monsters away from her temple. You know, it's a little bit of like the parent doing to her child what was done to her, which is not a defense, but like does give some like psychology. And I think when the show does bring Athena on after hearing so much about her in the first season, I think you're going to get some great scenes and hopefully a great performer to sort of bring that character to life.
Oh my gosh. Would you talk more about your role in episode 4 and 6 specifically? I know the writer's room is such a nebulous place, but how it sort of shakes down where who takes the lead on certain episodes, what drew you to those two?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the writer's room is super collaborative. So like, even though someone's names are on an episode, everyone has a hand in that. So regardless of whether you're credit or not, it's the brain trust of the room that makes something, you know, bigger than just what one person could do. So, you know, the way it fell, it just happened that those were the ones that, you know, you sort of send people off to script. And so those were the ones that I was available to script. But those were really fun because, of course, in the musical, both of those incidents, the arch and the lotus, are, you know, literal drive-bys in the song Drive. They get like a little cameo appearance. So to get to expand on them was really fun. And Echidna was someone who, you know, we'd written scenes for her for the musical. And, you know, I'd always wanted to sort of, you know, as a lesser known monster who has a really cool like backstory to her and sort of representation of Mother of Monsters is such a cool title.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was excited to get to play with her and make her a more present character. Yeah, I think we were talking about the Pyrrhus Olympus series and Gaia obviously being a big part in that. And Echidna is actually Gaia's daughter. And I said that to Daphne, and Daphne kind of went down a research rabbit hole. And, you know, a lot of what Echidna says in that speech on the train, I think came, you know, the idea of like, this has always been a family story, you know, came out of like kind of looking into the stories around Echidna and saying, yeah, there's a really fascinating perspective that this character would have as someone who is not quite demigod, not quite monster, and yet her children are labeled as monsters. They, you know, go to Tartarus when they die, so they're, you know, technically monsters. Yet, yeah, but for her, that's, you know, the demigod, the idea that she would see the demigods who kill them as the monsters, and that, you know, there is this sense that, yeah, like Percy has been fighting monsters, seems cool. Percy's been killing her children, not so cool. Echidna is right.
How far are you in the Riordanverse as a Percy Jackson fan? Have you read through like the Trials of Apollo? Like, sounds like you've read the Heroes of Olympus.
Oh yeah. It's, I mean, you know, I've obviously read, I think one of these bookshelves behind me has nothing but 7 copies of The Lightning Thief, because every time I like think I've lost my copy and I get another one. But I love all the books, and I would love to see Echidna return in some way. I feel like we left her as an open question.
Cryer back.
Yeah, Susan Cryer's phenomenal. Her performance is so good. I think like if there's a way for her to return, she has a lot of perspective to offer Percy. or Luke.
She could very easily show up on the Princess Andromeda.
You know, Luke needs a mother figure. Luke, you know, obviously Luke's got some mother issues. I'm pitching right here.
And then she's the mother of monsters and Luke himself, right? Like, I'm not a monster. Like, wow. I feel like John would go for that, low-key.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. Let's see. Episode 4 has so much to do with family, but so does episode 6.
Yeah.
The focus of that episode being Hermes talking about his relationship with Luke and his presence and the family story. You feel like you were able to like really tie like episode 4 into episode 6 in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's family. It's so much about with the series and what Greek mythology is about. But yeah, with Hermes, I think that came out of Luke is our antagonist, but he's a secret antagonist. He vanishes for so much of the story. And even though we have the Iris message as a way for him to pop up and be like, hey guys, remember this character? He's going to be important. You know, I think we kept looking for ways to bring his story to the forefront. And, you know, look, Hermes is the god of gambling. You know, he's the god of travelers. If you're looking for a way to get into the underworld, he's a psychopomp in mythology. You know, he's the one who tells heroes how to get into the underworld. So as we're looking for, you know, I think both with 4 and 6, looking for reasons why Percy and Annabeth and Grover would go to these places so that they had intention in their stories. You know, the idea that like, if you're being pursued by a monster, the St. Louis Arch isn't just a beautiful piece of architecture that Annabeth loves for that reason. It's a place that is connected to her mother. And, you know, as we're looking for, to make episode 4, hey kiddo, oh, you can play with my AirPods. Sure. AirPods, toddler toy.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, you know, trying to root that into, you know, a story about Annabeth. So we're making the arch connected to her mother. You know, episode 6, we've got that Luke Iris mentioned at the beginning. How do we keep telling that Hermes Luke story? And, you know, I think at first there was a sense of like, is it too much if we just put Hermes in the casino? And I think we kind of tiptoed around that for a while. We had a version where maybe it was just an aspect of Hermes, so you didn't have to cast that actor too soon. But I think John really had the right. He's like, let's like, you know, if you're going to go part way, go all the way. Let's embrace that. Mm-hmm. I think having an actor who could really, you know, could deliver a charming performance that also had a real sadness to it, like Lynn did, just gave so much to that episode and made the reveal of Luke as our villain in episode 8 so much more impactful because we had the sense of where he was coming from.
Oh, absolutely. Can I ask a really specific and stupid question about episode 4?
Yeah.
Since you're here, one of my favorite parts of that episode is the establishing shot of the St. Louis Arch, where I think they're like walking and there's like a puddle and they step in the puddle and the puddle reveals itself as the upside down reflection of the St. Louis Arch. Do you remember that being in the script, or was that like
that was all? I love that shot. It's all dry. I think it was like it probably said in the script like reveal of St. Louis Arch. So I was so happy that like they took that word reveal and actually gave it a really cool reveal.
They cooked on that. They were like, oh, you want to see the arch? You're going to see it upside down in a puddle.
Yeah.
Because it's the original. to go back to the tone question and the variance in the adaptation, something we've been talking about a lot in our like postseason conversations, like even amongst ourselves, has been about like the comedic aspect of the show and how you create the show as being like engaging and appropriate for audiences of all ages. And that like that comedy, it comes in a bit through dialogue, but it also comes in through like just character portrayal or like circumstance. We're curious about like conversations in the writer's room when it came to like, how do we make it quote unquote funny or like quote unquote silly enough or silly to the right degree for the medium?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love me a silly Percy, as the musical proves. You know, he's a goofball. He's, you know, the TV show does have such a different tone in that, like in the musical, it's easier for a character to sort of step out and joke about the moment because there is that degree of unreality, you know,
right.
You know, you put something, you know, put incredible VFX and realistic scenery and actual 12-year-olds on screen. There's an element of danger there that, you know, if you read the books, a lot of that humor does come through Percy's internal point of view. And so, you know, I mean, I think we're always looking for ways to bring out the comedy. And, you know, we have like a cast who are so funny in different ways. You know, Walker has such a jokester energy to him. Leah has like this incredible deadpan. And Arya obviously is like such a great comedic actor that is able to balance that comedy with heart. You're always looking for it. And I think certainly, once you see what the three of them can do together, I feel like you're going to continue to find ways to have like watch any interview with the three of them. They just crack you up. They are those characters. And I'm so excited for in future seasons to see how like their real life banter and chemistry sort of comes to continue to define who those three characters are on screen.
Yeah. It's something you said, I don't remember, I think it might have been on Radio Camp Half-Blood, about the tone was like, sure, there are similarities between Harry Potter and Percy Jackson, but ultimately, like, that is not the proper analog for this material. Like at all. It's not Harry Potter. And we say that all the time. We're like, it's simply not Harry Potter. Don't compare it tonally to Harry Potter. It's not the same thing. Like, the difference is that it is grounded in reality, and that's what makes it fun. And that's what makes it funny. Do you feel like what would you say are the closer analogs? Like, if it's less Harry Potter and it's more something else, do you have other pieces of media you'd be like, this is more Percy Jackson vibes?
I mean, it's interesting. I can't think of anything that is like Percy that came before Percy, but I do feel like now when you look at like middle grade action adventure books, especially, like Rick's voice was so influential in, you know, a generation of writers. And that idea of like, you have these deep themes that are meaningful and exploring what's like at the root of a culture or a person. And yet you have like a sort of modern day sensibility that contrasts that. I love, I love tones that walk a line. So like the idea that you can contrast the mythic and the modern, that you can have the god of the sea, who is a complicated figure, but he like walks around in a Hawaiian shirt. Like those, that to me feels like the spirit of Percy Jackson is like walking that line and you know, being able to sort of like keep one foot in both worlds. But yeah, I especially I think when the first Percy Jackson movie came out, there was a real desire to find the next Harry Potter. And I think that like, probably what went wrong with that movie was trying to make it a Potter clone when it's not Harry Potter. It has a more American sensibility. It's looser, it's funnier, it's sillier, but it also has like, you know, as I said, like Luke is a character who really couldn't exist in the world of Harry Potter, where there is a really good clear, like, look, there's no good Slytherins. Like you can say there's good Slytherins, but like, you know, but Luke has nuance in a way that you don't usually get from like a villain in a fantasy story, particularly a middle grade fantasy story. And I think that like Rick, did so many novel groundbreaking things that it does feel like the series has finally shed those Harry Potter comparisons to be recognized as its own thing.
Yeah. That's such a great, you know, I've never actually, for as much as we've thought about Luke, I've never thought about how Luke as a character is born out of the inherent groundedness of Percy Jackson. That like that is that's a drama villain, or like that's an HBO miniseries like, drama villain.
The central question of Percy Jackson, it's like, if the gods had kids in the modern day, what would those kids be like? And Luke is an answer to that question. The answer is he'd be pissed off because the gods are messy, complicated things, but they're not great parents. So, you know, I think like Luke, you know, when Rick had that initial idea, and I've never asked him, I'd love to ask him like the origin of Luke as a character, you know, just comes out of like the premise of your story. You ask that question and you say, well, it could be that character could be like Percy, they could be like Annabeth, or they could be like Luke. These are three very different characters who have very different perspectives on what it means to be a child of the gods. And to extrapolate the metaphor, a child in a world where you have authority figures who have ruled a certain way, and you are looking to have your own voice to make your own way in that world.
I love talking to you guys. So cool to hear like actual adult people. I told Daphne, I was like, you know, it feels like the more we talk to like the writers and everyone, I feel like it's talking to people who have read my diary, like my little childhood diary. Like all of a sudden all these thoughts that like lived in my brain, like they also live in other people's brains who are like professional adult creative people.
It's what makes the series so fun to talk about it, and so fun to adapt because there are so many layers beneath the fun.
Carter, do you want to ask about the car scene before we wrap the parking lot scene before we wrap up?
I think that the better follow-up is we've talked a little bit about Grover and the way that Grover's been adapted in the musical and also in the TV show, and something that felt especially salient in the two episodes that you took the lead on in 4 and 6 is this idea of bringing Pan to the fore much more in this early stage than it happened in the books. And also there are some, I think, related ideas, particularly in episode 4, we have this moment where Grover and Annabeth are getting into an ideological disagreement in the museum under the arch about, you know, like manifest destiny and like what does the arch mean as a monument and how we should feel about it. I'm curious to hear what the thought process was in framing Grover and making and fleshing out Grover as not just like a third member of the trio as far as personalities go, but also now as far as like he is someone who's holding down like a third pole ideologically and in terms of the way we understand the world now in the show and what the process was like in creating that.
Well, you know, so often you just go back to the book and that, you know, Grover having a different perspective on the St. Louis Arch as a monument is right there on the page. And it, you know, I think it's like maybe just a few lines, but it felt like that wasn't, you know, and when you're looking to what you're going to carry over from the page to the adaptation, yeah. That just felt like such an important part of who Grover is, particularly mm-hmm. as we were saying, hey, this arch is a monument to civilization, to progress. Well, those are words that you can have in quotation marks. And Grover, as a child of Pan, is going to have a very different perspective on that. So him looking at the sort of the stuffed bison and seeing, you know, what mankind has done to nature as a flip side to while Annabeth is going on and saying, look at the glory of the gods. Isn't this great? Yeah. Look at what humans can achieve. And Grover saying, well, look what they, you know, look at what sacrificed to get there. Wanted to give that, obviously Pan, the search for Pan is a big part of the second book. You know, it's a big part of what motivates Grover, even though it's, you know, kind of secondary in screen time in terms of what's motivating him in the first season. But yeah, wanted to have those moments, wanted to have looking out the train and seeing the centaurs run by, you know, wanting to have Grover playing that virtual reality game where he's searching for Pan. The idea that like this story is important for Grover, even if it's not getting the most screen time, it's still, you know, part of what makes the character tick.
We were so fascinated by that virtual reality Pan moment. We were like, is Pan going to be in VR? Are we going to do like an animated episode? Like, what does this mean?
What is the relationship between virtual reality and like Uncharted Wild Places? Is Pan secretly hiding in the internet?
In some early drafts, there was like, we were going to see inside the VR game and see the commandos, the Seder commandos.
Yeah, know, shooting the humans.
taking out hunters in order to get to Pan. I think, you know, budget wise, sometimes things have to be lost, but in my head, that's still, you know, the game is like, you know, it's like Grover in the jungles with, you know, pointing and shooting at hunters that pop up.
Wow. Oh, that's funny. So Pan probably won't pop up in like virtual reality metaverse then is what we're hearing.
It feels like that thing. It's like, you know, have you played a game where it's like, if I could just get to the next level, I would achieve my objective. And I feel like the game of the Lotus is like that. You're always going to be like one level away from finding Pan.
Right. Okay. You have this really amazing career where you've specifically worked on so much YA and middle grade material and adapting that for the stage, for movies, etc. What do you feel is important about people of all ages encountering material like middle grade and coming of age stories and how they can relate to everybody?
Yeah, I mean, I think I gravitate towards coming of age stories because it is a time in your life where everything is so heightened and you're learning about the world for the first time. Like it's where you shrug off just the things that you may have been told growing up and start asking questions and seeing things, you know, for yourself. And, you know, I think that's relevant at any age. Like it just happens to be when you're going from child to teenager to adult, those moments are so pronounced. You know, I love first, like your first love, your first time away from home, you know, your first experience of loss, like those first things are so potent. And so, you know, if you're going to tell a story, you know, you could tell a story about the 10th time somebody, you know, experienced loss, or you could tell about the first, tell a story about someone's 20th love, which is a very valid story. But there's something about that first love that I think everyone can connect to. So when it comes to teenagers, we all either have been one, we are one, or we will be one. And so there is something that's universal about that time of your life that I think is something that I really gravitate towards as a writer.
Absolutely. And you being like the king of adaptation, what would you say is something important for people to keep in mind when like adapting work or something you believe is like very like the crucial core tenet of adaptation of material?
I do think you have to love what you're adapting. And I've been lucky to love everything I've adapted. I think if you don't, you kind of, you know, it's easy to lose your way because when you adapt something, you are taking it apart in order to put it back together. And, you know, if you don't love it, you may put it back together in a sloppy way where it doesn't, those pieces don't work, that the watch doesn't tick, the, you know, pendulum doesn't swing. So I do think like, you know, and I've also been lucky that like everything I've worked with has been full of creative teams who love the material and just want to do it justice and are often either existing fans or newly discovered fans themselves.
I think that means our very last question for you is, of course, do you believe Persebeth is the greatest love story ever told?
I knew this one was coming.
We've been forgetting to ask people, and they've been like, why didn't you ask me that?
You send like follow-up emails. You're like, please, yes, no, baby. Check this box. Look, I mean, I think what's incredible about Persebeth is that you get to see them develop over the course of so many books. And when we were writing the musical, The Heroes of Olympus was coming out, and it was the first time that Annabeth had a point of view chapter of her own. And
yes,
getting to hear her take on who Percy was. Look, your character growth to get those two in the place that they are now is incredible. There's so much dimension. You see them over the years develop in real time, or not quite real time, because Percy's technically still 18.
Fair. 18 for until proven otherwise, or 17 and a half. Kind of
frozen in time.
Absolutely. So yes.
Yeah, obviously, yes.
Get that answer out of you.
What is it? Are you gonna say Luke and Backbiter? Come on.
Certainly not Luke and Selena. Yeah. Ouchie. Maybe it'll be the love story between Luke and Echidna, his caring mother figure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really excited about this now. I think, like, regardless of what happens next in the show, I think I'm gonna write that musical.
Do it. You could co-write it with Lynn.
Yeah, right. Oh, I know. Get Lynn, get Rob back in. We'll do a big little Percy Jackson collab.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us today, Joe.
Thank you. This
is
so much fun.
I have a feeling you're not allowed to talk about what you're currently working on, are you?
I am not allowed, unfortunately.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Whatever it is, we are very excited for it.
I'm excited too. And by the way, my child just returned the AirPods.
Perfect timing,
thank
right?
Thank you. Here, Chris. Yeah.
Oh my God.
He was born the day after my last writer's room. Say hi.
Hi.
I was talking about Luke and Kronos one day and the next. This kid was being born.
That's so special. Anything? Do you want to plug your socials or anything like that before?
I don't really have those. So I will say, The Lightning Thief and Be More Chill are both available to be done at a theater near you. We just released the Broadway West End version of Be More Chill, which is the sort of updated version that has all the songs we'd added. And The Lightning Thief is, you can, and anyone can do it. Please do it at your theater, school, cafetorium.
Oh, seeing it in my hometown at a high school was the best experience of my life. It was so fun.
Oh, right, you did. It was at our high school, right?
Oh, cool.
It was at a youth performing arts group in Honolulu. I saw it last year. It was amazing.
Oh, cool. Oh, I remember reading about that production. Becky is so good about shouting out on social media when there's a new production of The Lightning Thief. The most fun thing is to get to see like people getting to play those characters themselves and step into the shoes of their heroes. And when you see schools who can have like 60 people as opposed to the 7 we were able to have on Broadway.
That's the best.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Joe. This is so cool and very special for us to have you here.
Thank you. It's so much fun.
And good luck on your secret projects.
Yes. all the interviews you guys have been doing are awesome. Can't wait to see what you guys are cooking up next.
Thank you. All right, listeners, thank you for joining us, and we will talk to y'all next time. Bye.